Hey everybody, welcome back to New Hope Underground. This is one of your illustrious hosts.
Illustrious.
Lead pastor Tyler Sturkey coming at you.
T-H-E.
With me is Darren Hansen, discipleship pastor.
Hi everybody.
Your normal host for New Hope Underground. He's great. He's graciously allowing me to co-host with him today as we continue in this special supplemental series we're doing for the series of, that we're doing on Sunday mornings called Redeeming Ruth, going verse by verse through the whole book of Ruth.
It's been great.
Super good.
Yeah.
And so each week we've been taking a look back at the chapter that's being preached that week. And so I'm preaching through Ruth chapter 3 this week. And so we're jumping into, we're just going to read Ruth 3 together and just make noticings and make connections. And it's funny, I talked to someone this week and it's funny, I can't think who it is now off the top of my head, which they probably wouldn't want me to say their name anyway, but of them just saying, they're like, yeah, like I listened to, or no, they sent me a message and they said, like, I listened to the first 2 weeks podcast. They're like, I love it when you guys nerd out, like all the little stuff, like you maybe don't have time to like talk about in a message, or like you think a majority of people wouldn't care about. They're like, it's so cool. Like, I love all that.
I don't know if there's a spiritual gift of nerding out, but I think we have it.
Oh, I definitely have it. It's the nerd is strong.
I'll tell you what, get Tyler talking about Star Wars or something like that.
I've been reading some Lord of the Rings lately.
Ooh.
I've read the actual trilogy and The Hobbit like multiple times throughout my life. But there's a lot of extra content that was put out and like edited and put out as like single books that are all about like before, like way, way before the Lord of the Rings happens. It's all notes.
Before Silmarillion or whatever it is?
Yeah. Like it's, some of them are incomplete notes that Christopher Tolkien, his son, used to write the Silmarillion. Like, Tolkien wrote the Silmarillion in, or I guess it was technically his son wrote it in the 70s, I think.
Okay.
And it was basically a lot of incomplete stories and notes that he found of his dad's, and he edited them and then put them out as a single thing and called it the Silmarillion. Tolkien called it the Silmarillion and he put it out as a finished work. Well, there's just like a vast amount of notes that just never got used or published, different variations of the same story. And so there are three books that came out recently that were all edited by, I mean, it's technically Tolkien's writing, so he's attributed as the author, but his son is the one who's like in his 90s.
Oh, wow.
Like finished.
I was going to say, I wonder how old he is. Cause
yeah. Which I'm trying to think if Christopher Tolkien is actually still alive, like when it was finished, but they're all stuff from like, because I think the Lord of the Rings technically takes place in the Third Age in that world. Mm-hmm. And anyway, then the other stuff is like in the First Age. I mean, like thousands of years before. But it's stuff they reference in the trilogy, and like you have no idea what he's talking about. And so it tells the full stories. Anyway, I nerd out over that stuff.
Geography, you came up with languages.
Oh, yeah.
I'm just amazing.
And so I've been reading those recently and like, learning a lot of stuff that nobody cares about, but I think is interesting.
Wouldn't you love to be in that pub where Lewis and Tolkien and just listen to their conversation?
Yeah.
That would just be mind blowing.
Because like one of the stories is almost entirely, or at least a version of it, is written as a poem.
Wow.
Like the whole story is a poem. It's like the real simple, like, AABB, or it might be like ABAB type of thing, like a real simple structure, but the entire thing is just a poem, but it's the story being told, which is, it's just a different way of storytelling.
But wow,
that's the classics.
His books are not just Tolkien, I tell you that. I mean Tolkien.
Anyway, sorry, but we're not here to talk about that.
You want me to read Ruth 3 since you're gonna kind of comment?
Sure, yeah, go ahead.
Do you want me to read the whole thing?
Please.
Okay, here we go. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz a relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself. Put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say, I will do. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And at midnight the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, who are you? And she answered, I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant. You are a redeemer. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. And for all my fellow townsmen, know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. So remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she laid his feet until the morning, but arose one more before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? And she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. She replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today.
I love how at the, like the end it says, for the man.
The man
will not rest. Boaz means the man. The man won't rest until the matter settled.
He is the man.
So, I mean, it ends on a little bit of a cliffhanger at the end because it's resolved in chapter 4. But yeah, one of the things that I've noticed in this, and I mean, this is, and I talk about this in my message too a little bit, that again, the characters in this story are not models to follow. I mean, there might be aspects of their story that we identify with, but they're not models to follow, because I mean, you see some manipulation on Naomi's part, because we were talking about her being hopeless and being bitter and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, literally her saying like, I want to find a home for you. But then the more times I've read this chapter over and over again, I realize she's not just doing this for Ruth's benefit.
No.
Because he's saying he's a redeemer.
Yeah.
Meaning that if you get married to him, you'll get what you want. But then that child will be able to inherit Elimelech's land.
Yes.
Which then gives me land and life. And I mean, because I talk about in my message how land and lineage are everything to Israelites. Like, all the promises of God are centered on land and lineage, that your clan, your tribe, you're a part of this tribe of Israel or whatever. And they were all allotted land in the promised land, which was, that's God's land that God gave to them. And so for, you know, your children to die or your husband to die, that land goes then to another family or another, you know, group of people. Yep. or whatever. And that's like the worst thing that could happen to an Israelite, is for them to lose their ancestral land. And so then, and again, I explained it in the message a little bit, Deuteronomy 25, it talks about this idea of a redeemer, a kinsman redeemer. The NIV says guardian redeemer. Yeah.
The Hebrew is like goel?
Yeah.
Goel.
And I mean, essentially, it's
G-O-E-L.
It's this person who is able to, I mean, through the simple act of, and I just noticed, it's like, I mean, we're a good 5,000 years removed from these events in this culture. And so sometimes cultural differences like that, I mean, cultural differences today even can seem weird, but it's like we're 5,000 years removed from this, that, I mean, it's essentially, if you know, you, we'll pretend you're a woman, Darren. Just for a second,
sure.
And your and your husband dies, or your children die, and there's no one to pass the land on to. You know, similar to Naomi's situation. Yeah. And so, what a redeemer does is actually, and it might be your husband's brother, literally is like duty bound to sleep with you and give you children that will then be essentially in your brother's name. They won't be considered his sons.
Right.
They'll be considered your
Brother's sons.
His brother's sons to inherit that land so it doesn't have to be sold and given to someone else. Because literally that is the most important thing. Even more important than the weirdness of you having to sleep with
your brother. correct me if I'm wrong, but I think also the role of a redeemer is a legal thing.
Yeah, it's entirely legal.
Because of what they were. There were two things I read that I thought were interesting. One is that they would also come into play if their family lost the land because they got into debt.
Yeah, like your Jubilee stuff where
somebody, a rich person would come and buy it up. He would have the right to come and buy it back.
Yeah.
In the name of that family.
Yeah, exactly.
To restore it. And part of the reason for that, which I think is just genius, this is God at work here because these are his rules. Part of the reason for that is so that the rich wouldn't buy up all the land.
Yeah.
And enslave everybody.
And that's
it's so that the mom and pop farms could continue.
And that's something you see like as a problem even in the world today where it's like, the rich get richer, yeah. And they can just buy all the property and own all the prime real estate, which then produces even more wealth and things like that. And so for someone who wants to try to get ahead, like that can be hard of like, I can't because these people who can, it's funny just talking to someone who they're wanting to get a house and it's like, they go into that, like the, you know, just the way housing prices are, like into a bidding war, which they're able to like offer a good amount. But then finding out the other person offered cash and over.
Yeah.
And it's like, what do you do?
Can't win.
You can't beat that. Mm. And so, of course, something was like they like avoided a home, forwent the home inspection too. Like they said, you don't have to do a home inspection because they don't have to get a loan. If like you're getting a loan, you have to get a home inspection. Since they're paying cash, they didn't have to, which I'm like, that may come back to bite them later.
Yeah.
They have like a crack foundation and they won't know that.
Yeah.
But
you're right. I mean, there's so many things. And we're in a capitalist society. So it was a
justice thing too.
Yeah. We're in a capitalistic society, you know, so it's like, you know, it's kind of dog eats dog kind of thing sometimes. And there are things in place, supposedly, laws to protect, you know, people who are not as rich or whatever. But this is definitely something God put forth because they're so dependent on the land.
Yeah.
Not just to make money, but to eat, period.
Yeah.
You know, so we're talking about life sustenance.
It was a primary, yeah. I mean, it was primarily an agrarian society.
Yeah.
So like that was their, literally you said it, like it was their life. They would not have food or the ability to make money without owning the land. So then they become destitute. And so that was kind of Ruth and Naomi's, because I talked around identity in this
chapter. So it
really
is for Naomi. I mean, like you said, it's not just about Ruth. And what's interesting is, and I'll say this and be quiet a little bit, but looking ahead, I don't mean to spoil things in chapter 4, but it says in chapter 4, it talks about how the child is Naomi's.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And it shows that, again, and like my first point that I was making with that is she's an imperfect person. All of the people in this story are imperfect people doing imperfect things to live out their lives as we all do in one way or another. And so you see her, like her motives are not entirely pure, like, oh, I want you to have a family and for you to have a life. And so, hey, go marry this person that will just happen to restore my land.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's like, which I mean, it's, and I don't think Ruth was probably naive to that.
Ruth becomes Naomi vicariously.
Yeah.
Is what happens. And that's so Christ-like.
Yeah.
You know.
And so anyway, but then you even see there's a bit of a manipulation because she's like, you know, bathe, put on your best clothes, put on perfume, which was very uncommon in the ancient world. And I think some of that was pointing to because what she was about to do in the removing of the corner of your garment off your feet, that's all marriage imagery. Because there's a lot of scholars who debate like, oh no, she was like propositioning him for sex. But it's like, no, like, and I give the message, give multiple examples. There's examples in the Psalms. There's a very direct one in Ezekiel 18 of saying where the Lord even says, like, when I saw you were ready, I put the corner of my garment over you and made a covenant with you. It's marriage. So essentially what she is propositioning Boaz, not for sex, but will you be my husband? Will you take me into covenant so that, and I mean, there's identity stuff there. Our identity is we're destitute and poor and widows. But when you bring me into covenant with you, I'm absorbed into that's a new identity. I'm now included in that, in your family, when I had no family. And so, I mean, there's a lot of cool imagery there that I go into in the message, but it's Naomi. And I think in her, again, thinking she's potentially cursed by God, thinking this is entirely up to her to fix the situation. You know, she says, hey, they're going to be at the threshing floor. And that was, the end of the harvest. They're pounding out the grain to separate it from the chaff. One, that takes time, but also because it takes time, they sleep there to guard the grain so someone doesn't come and steal it.
Yeah.
It's bro time, where it's like, we've been working sun up to sundown for weeks. Now it's done. Let's celebrate the bounty that God has given us. And so they usually all get drunk. And she knew that because her husband owned land, Elimelech. She probably remembers that, the bro time. Oh, yeah, they're out at the threshing floor. So she's like, wait till they're done eating and drinking. And it says he's in, quote, and a note for the audio, I'm making air quotes, in high spirits.
Chris Farley going on.
Yeah, which basically means wait till he's drunk.
He's merry.
Yeah, he's merry to see if he'll marry you. If he gets merry enough, he'll marry you, type of thing. There's a bit of manipulation there of like, I'm waiting until he's a bit inebriated that maybe he'll be more likely to give in and do it.
Yeah. Not so inhibited.
Yeah. And he is, in fact, inebriated.
So we know that for a fact. I mean, Boaz is tipsy here.
I mean,
for lack of a better term.
I mean, it's not, it doesn't say drunk.
Yes.
But I was going to say, I'm looking back in the text.
He at least is, he's been celebrating.
He was in good spirits.
Yes.
I feel like it's a polite way of saying he was likely.
is that where we get the word spirits for?
Yeah, maybe.
Different kinds of liquors and beers.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. But then of course approaching that, and then it's just this beautiful moment of an identity shift. And then for him to say, the kindness that you have shown here, let's see how he actually words it. He says, the Lord bless you, my daughter. He replied, this kindness, this hased, is greater than that which you have showed earlier. Because he's like, you could have gone off to Moab and started over with a young guy, started over a family. But it's like, and because a lot of scholars think Boaz might have been a little bit older.
Yeah.
And which, you know, something I've always wondered, and this is, again, we're speculating because this is the space where we do things like that. You know, because Naomi had even talked about hypothetically, even if I got married again and had kids again, which she might have been able to, because likely she may have only been in her 30s,
right?
Maybe early 40s at the oldest,
right?
Could have still potentially had kids. I wonder if Naomi propositioned Boaz herself, if he would have married her, but it didn't happen because she just was resigned to hopelessness, resigned to the identity of widowhood. And so she said, well, I'll have Ruth do it because she may have been. Well,
Ruth kind of had the upper hand, if you will, because she went into his field. Remember the just so happened to go into his field.
Yeah.
So she met him. I'm not so sure Naomi was thinking to send her out to meet Boaz. She was just send her out to glean. Remember?
Yeah, exactly. So
the fact that she did, maybe Naomi thought, well, she's got the inside track now.
And maybe she was thinking, she's younger. I mean, some think Ruth could have been still a teenager, maybe like late teens.
Boaz could have been
in her 20s.
Boaz could have been pretty old.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read up to 80.
Yeah.
That old, because being a redeemer, you'd have to be one of the older.
But when I think about that, if Naomi was in her 30s, maybe 40s at the oldest.
Still young.
Like, she could have still had kids. Boaz may have actually married her. And done, but again, and some of this might have been identity stuff for Naomi. She's just can't possibly think something good. She may still think she's cursed by God. So why would I even try? Why would I even ask? But also thinking from the manipulative sense, he's more likely to say yes to a pretty young thing. You know, a teenager or 20-something-year-old Ruth.
It just shows how human this is.
Yeah, it's very human. And that's why I always want to double down on every Old Testament story. These are not models to follow.
Yeah.
They are pointing to the model,
which is Jesus. Don't you have a hard time, though, with... I was being honest. Sometimes I have a hard time with like looking at stories like this that are so human. Polygamy.
Yeah.
And saying God's using this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know what I mean?
Well, like, I'm in my own Bible time. I had just read this, like, as we're like getting ready to do and doing the first week of the series, I got into Ruth in my, like, read the Bible in a year plan. So it's funny to like read it in that time, but now I'm into the David story. And of course he's called a man after God's own heart, but it's like, he had two wives. Like, at the part I'm at, he's not king yet.
Commits adultery.
But he has two different wives, and then later he commits it, which he does get called for that. Yeah. But I'm like, but he doesn't get called out for the... And I mean, some of that just shows...
And murder.
And murder. Now, of course, I've heard different scholars talk about some of that is divine accommodation, that God is merciful, that there are lots of things that we're sinful in, maybe even now, that in his mercy... certain things are sliding because he's focused on growing us and moving us in the direction, because it was over a period of generations that eventually the Jewish people were moved to a man of one wife, you know, type of thing, to where polygamy is, you know, even by the first century, it was viewed as a sinful thing. So it took time for God to bring his people as a whole to the place of holiness that he wants them to be.
Well, I don't know if you have you heard this. We just got done with Soma recording on the story of Cain and Abel.
No.
And Cain's, the first time polygamy is mentioned is in Cain's line.
Interesting.
With Lamech.
Yeah.
He had two wives. First time it's mentioned. And these are, and if you know anything about his descendants, they were pretty evil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it didn't come out of like Seth, or if I make any sense to anybody, but sure. It's just interesting. I don't know, and the whole thing is just it's like, how does God use this? But that's the theme over and over and over again, isn't it? I mean, even Ruth and Naomi themselves. I mean, they came from Moab. You know, why did Ruth go to Moab in the first place? I mean, a lot of failure here is what I'm trying to say. Ruth is the one that doesn't seem to fail. She's Moab. She was raised, but she converts. She's the one that seems to be the most faithful out of all this.
Yeah.
And doing what her mother-in-law is telling her to do, even though it seems manipulative.
And it's
interesting. It's real interesting.
And again, even going back to the wider context of this is all during the time of the judges.
Yeah.
Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. So even these start and stop failed attempts at being, I mean, this was considered faithful.
Yeah.
Because you think even a sputtering little light looks pretty bright in absolute darkness.
Yeah.
So it's like even some of these, which again, nobody's perfect. We all have I've had my moments of manipulation of me trying to use a situation for my own gain and good. So for me to like sit in judgment on Naomi, I'm not doing that whenever I say it. I'm just pointing out that we often read, especially the Old Testament, of like, you know, oh, be like David who, you know, faced down the giants and killed them. And I'm like, that's not the point of that story. The point of that story isn't, oh, you can face your giants and slay them. No, the point is Jesus is David.
Mm.
He slays the giants. Mm-hmm. He's your David. Mm. He's the giant slayer. Yeah. You look to him. Like, that's what it's always pointing to Jesus.
Why did even David go out there and refuse armor? He didn't feel like he had the power to do it either.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the thing that's fascinating to me is our theology is so screwed up, man, because we get to the place where we really believe that God's okay with us over every individual particular sin, the things that we're committing and doing in our life. He's either okay or not okay with us.
Mm.
And so our spiritual lives, we would say, go up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down, because we're looking at ourselves.
Yeah.
We're not looking at the victory we have in Jesus. And not only that, but David and Saul, I tell people this all the time, like, you know, Saul was obviously the bad king. David was the good one. But if you set their actions side by side, who was worse?
Ooh. Oh, that hurts a little bit to think
from
about.
From what we know about.
Yeah.
But we know who got accepted and who he rejected. Mm. Why? Because of things like Psalm 51.
He was
the heart of David.
Well, I remember someone saying, I know we're getting to David and we don't mean to do that.
Yeah, but, sorry.
No, it's fine. I remember someone saying that about David, that what made him a man after God's own heart was not that he did all these amazing things and followed the rules really well and always did what God wanted him to. It's that he was a man of repentance.
Mm, yeah.
And Saul wasn't.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
And you just got to think that Boaz and Ruth and the blessings of God in this whole thing, that there was... doesn't mean they did. We're seeing things they didn't do right.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that their hearts weren't.
And so, and I said this in my message too. Sorry, it's hard not to talk about some of the stuff that you talk about in the message too. I know we always want to like expand beyond it, but it just fits so well. Cause the point I make where I touch on the whole model thing of like, we don't view these people as models. I mean, I think we can identify with the characters in different aspects, but it's like what I found personally, how I identify with any of the, especially the Old Testament characters, I don't identify with them in aspects of what I should be. I identify with them in aspects of need. That I see brokenness in them, and I identify with the brokenness of like, I've had my moments of bitterness. I've had my moments of manipulation. I've had my moments of hopelessness, and I need a kinsman redeemer. Yeah. I need a redeemer. And so it's not, oh, ladies, if you're not married, wait for your Boaz. I'm like, no, Jesus is the true Boaz. Mm. Your redeemer's already come. Mm. So I'm like, this isn't about how to find a husband. This is about we need redemption, and Jesus has done that. He fulfilled what Boaz was a model of, what Boaz pointed to. Jesus was the fulfillment of it. Anything else is I'm just identifying with need, not, oh, you should be like that person.
Boy, that really needs to preach for us.
Yeah. Well, I do in my message a little bit.
Well, I mean, just in our life, like literally, he's the father to the fatherless.
Yeah.
And the husband to the widow.
Yeah.
He's literally these things. You know, I remember a long time ago, I had to preach a sermon on, and it was hard because we're going through a text, and the text was basically talking about, you know, basically I was talking to single women. Mm. And
just as a general rule, I don't talk to single women.
it was in the sermon to a group of people, but the kind of the content. And my main theme was, I know it's so hard. Some of you gone through divorce, through pain, through hurt. You've been rejected, and you've had to raise kids on your own. But do you realize you have a husband?
Mm.
And you know, he came to be your husband. You know, I mean, and I don't mean that like in a sexual sense or anything like that, of course. I just mean that in a real intimate sense that he is there for those who feel like you have nothing left. You know, like you said, the need. I love how you phrased that.
Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, man, there's just a lot of cool stuff around identity here. And then it just kind of ends with a cliffhanger where he says, yeah, I'll be your redeemer, except there's someone closer and I need to go talk to him.
I can't figure that out. Do you know anything about that? Historically?
I've been having conversations with Jonathan. He's wrestling a lot with chapter 4 of like trying to figure out, because there's a big chunk of it is like a legal scene, which I don't mean to steal his thunder by bringing that up.
Well, it doesn't quite match up with a lot of the laws and things.
Because so there's a lot of scholars that debate, like, was that actually really an example of Levirate marriage in the truest sense?
Not sure.
And scholars disagree on it, which, of course, it's said in the time of Judges, so there's a part of me that it's like, what does it matter? Nobody was doing what they were supposed to do anyway, so that might just be par for the course.
Maybe their obscure look at the laws, I mean, the way that they're living out this obscured
They're trying idea. To live it out in their imperfect understanding of
right,
it.
Right, right.
Might possibly be it, but that's kind of where it's left at the end of that chapter is, I need to go talk to this guy and see if he wants to actually be the redeemer, and if he doesn't, then I will. And so you're kind of left on a cliffhanger like, okay, well, what's next week on Redeeming Ruth, you know, we find out what specifically
And the
happens.
Point of contention is Ruth.
Yeah.
With that. I mean, the whole, and why?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's interesting.
So anyway, but yeah, we'll touch on that next week when we unpack the last part. So, well, hey, thanks, Darren, for...
Thanks, Tyler. It was awesome.
Coming on New Hope Underground. And,
hey, I'm here to nerd out.
That's right. So, hey, we'll see you guys later. See you next week. We'll be right back.